From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Thanks for joining us. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. Let's open the Week in Review with a little debate about Uber and Lyft. Last week, hundreds of Uber drivers went on a one-day strike to protest wages and working conditions. They want to be deemed employees, not contractors, and they want more pay and benefits. We welcomed a couple of Uber drivers who explained that the setup works for them because it's a side hustle, it's part-time, they bring in a little extra money each week. But labor leaders say that Uber and Lyft are bad for workers who need full-time opportunities.
So in this clip, we're going to start by hearing from the Chamber of Commerce CEO, Bob Duffy, defending Uber and Lyft. He says these companies are innovative with what they're doing and they give consumers what they want, which is a net positive. Then you'll hear labor organizer Franny Sobchak, followed by Jesse Lenny of the Working Families Party. Let's listen.
That's the way of the world. I mean, we're, again, taxi cab accessibility in this region is not like being in Midtown Manhattan. It just isn't. So I think Uber and Lyft, they serve a purpose. And plus, it's the changing in our economy. It's our, you know, next generation leaders, that you're seeing all this begin to evolve. So I wouldn't criticize it. There's probably been some hiccups along the ways. I think you'll see much more of that coming. I think whenever I've used Uber, it's been great. My son-in-law uses it quite a bit. Sometimes they're not always available at 3 o'clock in the morning for catching an early flight at the airport. They don't have maybe the core number here all the time, but it is a great way to earn some money. And, you know, I think it's just part of the evolution you're seeing in our society. Things are changing.
All right, Franny, what do you think?
Okay, well, it's good. He can sit up there and he can look down and he has a different perspective. But what's going on down here in the ground is totally different. Okay, these the two gentlemen you have on right now, they do it part-time, you know, and they're not making basically that much money, you know, $10, $15 an hour. That's all well and good. That's part-time work. But I think somehow, some way, we have to get this figured out because there are people that do this for a living now. And it's like any other gig job. You know, we got to get this figured out because it's hurting workers. Workers are losing money. And it translates back into our communities because if these people that are losing work and everything from competition, which competition's great, it makes everything better. Technology is great. It makes everything better. But why are we creating two groups of workers? One group of workers that have to abide by rules, regulations, have to pay fees, astronomical fees, and everything. And the other group basically don't have to abide by the same rules and regulations.
All right, so let me
That's the problem.
Let me ask Jesse Lenny. You heard Bob Duffy's comments. You heard Arian Horbovitz earlier this hour saying his concern, even as an Uber driver, is that this could be sort of the metastasizing of the gig economy into other sectors, that other sectors are going to see this and they're going to say, we're going to find a way to Uber Lyft what we're doing. Do you share that concern? And to Duffy's point, do you feel like even if that happens, this is about convenience for the consumer, and that's the direction the world's moving in.
I just think it's convenient for someone like Bob Duffy or myself to say this is just the way of the world. We have jobs with pensions, and I have a union mm-hmm. job. He has a state job. So it's convenient for us to get that and then say, well, it's the way of the world for everybody else. You're going to work for $3 an hour and not have any benefits mm-hmm. and not have a pension and just tough noogies. Mm-hmm. But so I just think that's – I don't really – it's not, frankly, worth responding when someone says that. It's, you know, we have a responsibility. I don't want to live in a world where – I'm the last person to have a pension.
Next, if you went to college, a question for you. Are you using your degree in the way you thought you would? This week, we discussed the skilled trades, and our guests are concerned that public schools push college, 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 while neglecting to mention the potential benefits of working in the trades.
In this clip, we hear from Melissa Geska, president of the U.S. Ceiling Corporation. She went to college, but then her life took an interesting turn.
I wanted to say, as a person who went to college as a history major, getting certified to teach, now as a president of a construction company,
exactly what you thought you'd be doing.
It's
right?
Exactly what I thought I would be doing. But what I learned in college was how to think, right? Mm-hmm. So critical problem solving, how to kind of assess and receive information, process information quickly, and then make quick decisions and execute well. Well, that is exactly what you learn within the skilled trades. You're basically putting together puzzles every single day of your life on a construction project, and you're thrown curveballs constantly. So you're having to critically think through challenging circumstances, things that you could not have foreseen, and figuring out how to have a successful outcome. So I think that's another transferable skill set that you're gaining through the industry that I think a lot of people completely miss.
Now, that comment you made about being, what, a history major, you said?
Yes.
That is, at least, I know, ringing in my ears is the recent conversation about the humanities of people saying, look, at least you did learn how to think and solve problems. So they're going to say, hey, that's a vote in favor of higher ed in that way. Did it help you? Did that either that degree or that experience at least help you on the path you've been on?
I think it most certainly helped me. I think I'd be foolish to think that it didn't help me. I think what I've learned, however, in the last 18 years has been an exponential value more than what I've learned in the 4 years in college. And I really looking out and looking among the peers that you're working with. So, in a company of construction, looking out and learning from my field workers things that just completely blow my mind. Things about, contracts that I didn't think about that came from a perspective of a laborer that raised a question. So if you come to any career path with, wanting to learn and being inquisitive and asking great questions, I think that you have unlimited potential in the opportunities to learn and also to be able to ascend to whatever aspiration you have.
Next, we welcomed award-winning author Mira Jacob to Connections. She's coming to Rochester in June as a guest of Writers and Books to participate in their Ladder Literary Conference. Jacob's newest book is an illustrated work called Good Talk. It's a kind of memoir of life in an interracial family. In particular, the book focuses on conversations Mira had with her young son. Mira is Indian. Her husband is white.
In this clip, she's talking about how her son came to understand his identity and how he views himself in the United States of America. Let's listen.
At the time, my son was 6. He was obsessed with Michael Jackson, which I know means a different thing now. But at the time, he was a brown boy whose color landed somewhere between me, his brown mother, and his white Jewish fathers. And he was obsessed with Michael Jackson. And he was asking all sorts of funny questions. And some of them were hilarious, like what happened to his other glove? And some of them were really hard to answer, like, is he brown or is he white? And, that depends on, I said to him, well, he's black, but he sort of looks brown, and he turned white. And he said, he turned white? And I said, yes. And he said, are you going to turn white? And I said, no. And he said, am I? And I was like, no. And he said, daddy? And I said, daddy's already white. And he said, but was he always? So I had this problem, which is that I had this kid asking these really funny questions. And then some of them were really getting harder to answer. Like, does Michael Jackson, what is he like being better? Does he like being brown or white better? And then one day he asked me, there's a kid named Ferguson who got shot by a white policeman because he was brown. And I said, whew, his name was Michael Brown. And he was shot in a town called Ferguson by a white policeman. And so what this means is all of this was coming to a head. And I knew I had to write something about it, but I couldn't write it in an essay form because I just felt like no one would believe me. So I sat down and drew it instead. And that's what this book is. It's a series of questions that he was asking me that I then started asking myself and led me think about my life in this way. And it was all those conversations that sort of rumble around in your head and tell you who they are, who you are, but you don't ever kind of come to grips with them until something like a national crisis happens, and then you're forced to.
Mira, I'm going to quote from the New York Times, if I could, taking a look at your book, and I want to talk about the way we talk to our kids and the conversations we choose to have and not have, and then who gets to choose to have these or not. Because as a white guy with a white son who's 7, we could probably get through a lot of life without talking a whole lot about things like race and identity in our society, whereas others don't always have that choice. And here's what the New York Times writes. Quote, over the years, though, Mira finds plenty of people who do just that, who tell you that you're not American. And in the wake of 9/11, the horror binds people in the city together. But then there are others, like a man at a bar Mira goes to, who suddenly feels emboldened to make comments like, how do we know you aren't plotting to kill everyone in here if you won't even talk to us? I guess America kind of got weird for us for a while, Mira tells her son, while withholding all the micro and macro aggressions she's endured on the subway, in a diner, on the street, end quote. So that word withhold is interesting. You're trying to talk to a child about what America is becoming or what these moments mean when somebody might say to you in the bar, how do we know you're not planning to kill us? While also saying, am I going to say everything about what someone said on the subway? How do you choose what to talk about and what not to talk about?
Such a good question. And I will tell you, nobody wants to be having these conversations with their kids. We would much rather be talking about, Little League or whatever it is that, you know, something light, something that seems like it's appropriate for a 7-year-old. But you can't do that when the television set is bringing in the news and he turns to you and says things like, does the president not like brown boys like me? And you have to kind of answer that in a way that doesn't lie to him and also doesn't scare him too much. What I personally try to do is just answer the question I've been asked and not kind of further ahead all the reams of kind of sad knowledge I've accumulated about where that question comes from and why and what it could mean. Because I found that those things that I think are preparing him, it's not really great preparation. When those hard moments happen, they happen. There's no amount of me trying to bolster him for what it feels like to be rejected by a white friend or parent or teacher or lover. There's nothing I can say that's going to make sense of that for him. But I can kind of tiptoe cautiously toward it with him where I answer the part that he asks, and then I always reflect back on what it meant for me. And I'm just open to the conversation. Whatever he asks is kind of what I go with.
We'll close with a little debate about history and fiction. An obscure little musical just concluded a sold-out run in Rochester. You might have heard of it.
How does an orphan render Scotsman dropped in the middle of a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by providence, impoverished and squalor, grow up to be a hero and a scholar? The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter. By 14, they placed him in charge of a trading charter.
And every day while slaves were being slaughtered and carted away across the waves, he struggled and kept his guard up. Inside, he was longing for something to be a part of. The brother was ready to beg, steal, borrow, or barter.
Then a hurricane came and devastation rained. Our man saw his future drip, dripping down the drain. Put a pencil to his temple, connected it to his brain, and he wrote his first refrain, a testament to his pain. Well, the word got around, they said this kid is insane, man. Took up a collection just to send him to the mainland. Get your education, don't forget from whence you came, and the world's gonna know your name. What's your name, man?
Alexander Hamilton. My name is Alexander Hamilton, and there's a million things I haven't done, but just you wait, just you.
Hamilton is a massive hit, but some historians say it gets too much wrong. In this clip, our panel responds to a listener who argued that we shouldn't nitpick historical fiction. We should allow the creators of historical fiction to entertain us, even if they get the facts wrong. First, you'll hear SUNY Geneseo history professor Michael Oberg, followed by Brockport English professor Miriam Burstein, and then award-winning author Linda Sue Park.
It's okay to have a standard for accuracy. It's okay to have fun at the play. It's okay to want to have an audience leave with questions. Do with this play whatever you want, right? I mean, that's fine by me, you know? Walk away with it, enjoy with it. I think it's fantastic that you're looking into more information. And I think if you do look for more information, you go beyond biographies and you look into this world, you'll realize how fascinating, how diverse, how complicated, how fragile the freedom was during the revolution that celebrated in that play, how contingent everything was, and you get a much richer picture of it. The play is just a start, and Lincoln's just a start, and whatever other movie you want to talk about.
Miriam, what do you think?
Yeah, I think Tom really touches on the question of just how, at a certain point, the author can't control what the audience is going to do, right, with that play. I mean, and certainly when I'm thinking of the Hamilton phenomenon, I mean, you get if you look online and you look around, I've looked at the websites that have been generated, and you see people, for example, at Genius, the people who have annotated the entire Hamilton score, right? I mean, that you get, on the one hand, people who have been motivated to do this very intensive research, and then you get people who have been motivated to do very different things with the Hamilton text. That most historical novelists would, I think, say, well, we would like people to do a bit more research, that we'd like you to become curious. But sometimes that curiosity, right, where that curiosity takes people is often incredibly unpredictable, and sometimes goes in places where not only can the author not predict it might be the opposite of what the author wants them to do.
Linda Soom?
I guess my objection here is to the apparent opposition of fun or entertaining and accuracy. Mm-hmm. I'm not down with that. I see my job as writing historical fiction to make the accurate entertaining.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Important
mm-hmm.
distinction.
Yeah.
You know, thank you, Tom. Yeah, go ahead.
Another thing is that, like, I'll defer to you two, right? The American Revolution doesn't really have its Dr. Zhivago or... Mm-hmm. It doesn't have its great novel of the revolution, in my view.
Johnny Tremaine?
Right. Well, that's, you know. And
exactly.
And how old is that? Right. I mean, it's like, you know, so I mean, I don't think this play is it. I would rather, I think there's a greater work to be done out there. But part of it is we don't have that novel.
And that is another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370. On WRUR, it's 88.5 FM. On WEOS, that's Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
And we are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan, I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everyone, and we will talk to you Monday.